Welcome to the Jonah Carey Podcast, friends. Thank you for tuning in. Today's guest on the podcast is Burke Badenhop. The Hopper is a former major league pitcher, a sidearmer of sorts, three quarters, if you will, a slinger, a soft tossing slinger. Despite being a rather tall gentleman, he was not a hard thrower. We got into that in the podcast. It's an interesting thing. I remember the pitcher, was it Chris Young? I think he might still be hanging around the fringes, or was as recently as last year. 6'10", and you know, typically threw 90, 91. And there's expectations that come with being real tall and big and whatever. Hopper, not quite that big, maybe 6'5", 6'6", but same sort of thing. So we got into all that. And interesting career, and interesting guy, real smart guy, too. We talked about lots of various baseball things. He's now a special assistant to the general manager for the Arizona Diamondbacks. I've been doing that for a couple of years, and Diamondbacks have had a really nice turnaround in the last couple of years with their pitching. Badenhop playing a role in that. Obviously, Dan Herron, another former podcast guest on the Jonah Carey Podcast, is involved in that as well, and their pitching coach, Mike Butcher. It's a good blend of kind of meat and potatoes, pitching coach approach, and also blending in analytics and all that good stuff. So Butch and Herron and Badenhop and Mike Hazen, all those gentlemen doing a nice job over there. The Diamondbacks have had a nice turnaround over the last couple of years. Also some Game of Thrones talk, by the way. So if you have not watched up until the end of the most recent season of Game of Thrones, then at about the 30-minute mark or so of this podcast, you can just turn it off because we talk about Game of Thrones. Because Burke enjoys the show greatly, and I'm also a fan, and so we have a good chat. So I hope you enjoy all of that good stuff. Hey, and I also hope you enjoy the sponsor of this week's podcast, and that is our old friend SeatGeek. Hey, you know what? SeatGeek's fantastic. SeatGeek has been a sponsor of the Jonah Carey Podcast for quite a long time now, in its many iterations, and it's the best place to buy and sell tickets to anything you could possibly want. Sports, concerts, what have you. I have used SeatGeek for baseball and for hockey and for concerts, and they are great. It's a color-coded map, makes it really easy to use. You can see where in the stadium or arena you want to sit and get a feel for it based on whatever the best deal happens to be that particular day, and it tends to be different every time. So you might end up sitting in the upper deck or behind home plate or down the third baseline or whatever. And they are terrific for doing all that stuff. Very analytical approach and a great one at that. And how about this? If you download this free SeatGeek app and enter the promo code Jonah today, you'll get $20 off of your first SeatGeek purchase. Also, if you've already used SeatGeek, but you know what, you're going to a baseball game, well, that's okay too. Use the promo code Carey, that's K-E-R-I, for $10 off of MLB tickets. Again, $10 off MLB tickets if you use the promo code Carey, or just go ahead and use the promo code Jonah and get $20 off of your first purchase if you've never used SeatGeek before. They're fantastic. You should use them. They slaughter all other secondary market vendors, and you should get on that. Feh to the others, I say, SeatGeek is the way to go. Some programming notes. We have got writing from time to time at CBSSports.com. And also, we got to talk about CBS Sports HQ. I am doing hits constantly on that platform. You can watch CBS HQ on the CBS app through your Roku or Apple TV or what have you. Or you can just go to CBSSports.com, click on the link at the bottom of the page. It's streaming all the time, and you'll get news and analysis throughout sports. Lots of baseball talk with me. And you know what? You can get the best highlights and biggest sports stories in your inbox every morning with the CBS Sports HQ newsletter. That's packed with all the good stuff you need to see before you start your day. Just go to cbssports.com/HQ Daily to subscribe. So get on that as well. And that'll do it. Check out all that good stuff and check out this lovely edition of the podcast. It is with Burke Badenhop. Enjoy. Burke Badenhop, welcome back to the Jonah Carey Podcast, your second time. How do you feel?
I feel great, refreshed, very refreshed and ready to go.
Nice. I love it. It's been like 5 years since we spoke. At that time, we had, what, Henderson at Axford? It was an all-brewers bullpen edition. I feel like a lot has changed in the last 5 years.
Yeah, for sure. I actually was texted with Axford not too long ago. And it's like, can't believe it's been 5 years. I had no kids at that time. I have two kids at this time.
Oh, my God.
John Axford's still playing baseball. So
he is.
You know, some things change, some things stay the same.
John Axford back in his homeland, no less, too. So two Canadians and an American. And here we are 5 years later. Also, my dog is freaking out behind us, so that'll make for some fun soundtrack. So I think that in this case, because there's, you know, just it's a one-on-one, I want to get more into detail about kind of how you came into baseball and all that good stuff. You know, it's an interesting thing because you are a pretty big guy. And I would imagine that, you know, as you were coming up and developing as a pitcher, you know, were there expectations like, oh, wow, this guy should come in breathing fire and throwing 98? Like, what was your path like as a guy who was tall and supposedly projectable and all that stuff? Who had good stuff, major league stuff. You pitched in the big leagues for a bunch of years, but you weren't necessarily throwing an Aroldis Chapman velocity. Was it a matter of kind of convincing people, hey, look, my skill set is different than what you might expect? Or, you know, how did that go?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You mentioned that. Like, no, I was always good, never great. You know, like when I played Little League and stuff like that, I was, you know, one of our better players and a good pitcher, you know, when you're like 12 years old and stuff like that. And being tall, my dad's 6'6" and left-handed, he didn't pass that on to me, but he was a basketball player, and I just kind of took to pitching more. And I mean, I was pretty much like the definition of late bloomer, probably almost like a never bloomer, but just late enough, you know, like my senior year of high school, like I just found, you know, some velocity coming into my senior year to where I was, you know, throwing upper 80s. And the same thing when I got to college, like I wasn't throwing 90 miles an hour till my senior year. And stuff like that. Having gone just through the draft and seeing the other side of it and being involved in that side, it's very interesting in how I got my chances. Basically, I was explaining to one of our scouts that the scout who had covered Ohio and Indiana and stuff like that for the Detroit Tigers, it was his first year scouting, and so no scout likes to get shut out. You know, everyone wants to get somebody drafted, and being that it was his first year draft, they didn't want to have, or first year working for the Tigers, they didn't want to bring him in and draft none of his players. You know, it's kind of, you know, against what the whole process is about. So they had called him the morning of the draft, the second day back when the draft was only 2 days, and said, we're gonna grab this middle infielder from Cincinnati for you, and we'll sign him, blah, blah, blah. And thankfully they did that because he, you know, was like, actually, I'd like this Burke Badenhop kid. I think he might go pretty quickly, and, you know, I really would like him too. And sure enough, the Phillies had called me later that morning. We're like, oh, we're going to take you, you know, pretty early. We'll get you down to Clearwater, blah, blah, blah. The first round comes up. The Tigers pick 6 picks before the Phillies, and they pick me, you know, and I luckily enough get into a organization like the Tigers that had, you know, pretty good stuff, a very, very beneficial trade to get to the Marlins, you know, and I actually just saw my first big league pitching coach, Mark Wiley, who works, in pitching. He does stuff for the Colorado Rockies. I had bumped into him at the SEC tournament, and I was surprised how much he remembered. I mean, he obviously knew who I was, but he had a lot of details. He's like, man, and this kind of sums up your question. He's like, man, I just remember we kept sending you out there your first spring training. You give up a couple hits, you get a double play, you get everybody out. We're like, what in the world's going on with this guy? But you just kept getting guys out. And so eventually, I think, you know, by the end of the day, you just keep getting guys out and you're going to find your way to the big leagues. And if you continue to get guys out in the big leagues, you know, you're going to find your way to stay. And, yeah, I mean, definitely a different skill set for me, relying more on movement than velocity. But I also came in, you know, I threw around 90 miles an hour-ish, which was soft-ish then, would be, like, massively soft now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I came in at a good time and, you know, kind of found my way to the bullpen in an in-between role. And just you get enough guys out, you know, you get to stay, I guess.
And that extreme ground ball tendency, too. I mean, was that always your calling card? Was it a matter of coming up? You're just like, okay, you know, I'm going to, and I guess, you know, you never quite threw from 12 o'clock, right? That you had a little bit of a...
Oh, not even close.
Yeah, right. So you had that lower angle and all that stuff. So were you discouraged from doing that coming up? Because it's not conventional. You're supposed to go straight over the top, Kerry Wood style, fastball curve, and that's it. And here you are, you know, I wouldn't say that you're Dan Quisenberry, but you're definitely doing things in a different fashion. Were you... You know, were other coaches trying to fix you, or were they just like, okay, this guy's going to pitch this way and that's that? Because it's definitely unorthodox.
Yeah, and that's something that people ask me now, too. They'll be like, well, you know, did you have pitching coaches or guys that, you know, you really credit with your development? And I'm like, actually, no. I'm just glad that no one tried to do that, you know, that, like, they kind of left me to – I mean, I was a college senior. I signed for $1,000. Honestly, I probably wasn't worth their time, you know, like their develop, you know, there were so many pitchers ahead of me in the Tigers organization that, you know, being a somewhat level-headed kid with, I guess what you'd say, like somewhat of a clue, they just kind of let me do my thing. And, I had pretty good mechanics. Like I didn't have anything that would pop out. That's like, oh, this kid's going to blow his arm out. So that probably gave me the benefit of the doubt, but I actually came upon becoming kind of a sinker baller almost by accident. I really was like a four seam changeup guy in college. My ball moved a decent amount, but I could never throw two seam fastballs because the seams are raised so much on college baseballs. It's like tear my fingers apart. Yeah. Oh, wow. Just tear my fingers apart. Cause I grip the ball relatively firm. And, I got to my first like short, full season of, single A, and I just kind of gripped the two seam when I normally would a four seam to kind of like, say, stretch a corner away to a right-hander. So I grew up a big Braves fan. So like I'm trying to widen the plate, Maddox and Glavin and, you know, Molt style and everything. And so I gripped this two seam fastball to throw it down and away to a right-handed hitter. And the guy just like took it like he'd never, like it never saw it. Like he didn't know what was going on. And like that basically that backdoor sinker kind of came to birth there in the Midwest League for the West Michigan Whitecaps. And I went from throwing probably 60% four seams and 40% two seams to throwing like 90% two seams. And then realized that, hey, I could throw this. I could fool guys bringing the ball, you know, off the plate to on the plate. And when they hit it on the ground for the most part. And I just kind of rolled from there and you know, just by accident, became, you know, one of the better sinker ballers, I guess, in our organization.
I usually try to go in a little more linear fashion, but since we're talking about baseballs, I want to bring this up. It was interesting to hear from Marcus Stroman last year. And Marcus Stroman, one of the most outspoken guys. Piper, it's okay. My dog is very excited. So Stroman was talking about the seams on the baseball and how, you know, everybody knows, well, I think it's a poorly kept secret at this point that the ball is whatever you want to say, juiced, that it definitely travels more and what have you. But he was also saying that the seams were different and that he'd never had a blister in his life and that all of a sudden he had blisters. What have you noticed about today's baseball? You know, you're teaching, you're working with the Diamondbacks and helping a whole staff full of guys. When you look at a ball or touch a modern ball, does it feel very different to you, whether it's the seams? Does it seem like it's traveling in a different way? Because, you know, we're sort of sitting here from the outside talking about studies and all that, but you're actually on the front lines.
Yeah, so, like, my last season would have been 15 in the big leagues, which is kind of when these, you know, changes or things started to happen. So, like, in terms of, like, full-bore pitching with the ball, probably I didn't notice anything, you know, necessarily, but like, I think, I mean, you see the Rich Hill stuff, you see, you know, the Aaron Sanchez, the Stroman stuff. And I mean, just from whatever it is, I haven't noticed the seams because balls can be very different seam to seam. Like you can get some with decent seams. You can get some with no seams. You'd be surprised, I think, the average fan at just how different one baseball can be from the next. I mean, you look at a bucket of baseballs, a lot of them, they're not all going to be the same. And when you're talking about big league pitchers, the littlest thing can make the biggest difference, you know? So what average person is not going to see a big league pitcher throwing this ball into the stands, you know, cause they don't want it. So things are definitely, I think probably a little bit different now, like the home run rate's kind of gone the other way, I guess, right now. But yeah, I think to Stroman's, yeah, when things do change, like, yeah, it's going to make a difference on fingers or things like that. It's really, it's funny, you know, as pitchers, we don't get a lot of credit for being athletes and things like that. And it doesn't help when things like blisters are like taking us out of for seasons, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I want to see less of those things happen, I guess.
Well, and I want to follow up on that point too, because I think that that's another misunderstood thing that, you know, especially the ignoramuses out there, they'll be like, I watch football. A guy plays with a torn ACL and a broken head and whatever.
Right.
Here are these baseball players are complaining about blisters. What does a blister do to a pitcher? How does it affect grip, the ability to throw? Like, how bad is it if you get a really nasty one?
Oh, it's really bad. Like, I mean, it can be really tough. And as somebody who was, like I said, I gripped the ball pretty firm. So I would actually, I threw off, most people either throw off of their fastball off like their middle fingers or both fingers.
Yeah.
I predominantly threw off of my index finger.
Hmm.
So I put a lot of pressure on the inside part of my index finger to the point where, so you talk about the difference in baseball. So like minor league balls are a little bit softer than big league balls. And when I got to the big leagues, my index finger nail started like breaking.
Oh.
So because of the pressure, I just wasn't used to it. And it took me literally 4 years to find something that kind of worked.
Wow.
But there'd be times in my first couple years with the Marlins where my index finger would be like bleeding and like on the mound. And like, so you're trying to alter things and stuff like that. The only time I've had a full on like blister, I was in the Florida State League, and like, this is how crazy, like, I was pitching against the Brevard County Manatees when they had a pretty good high A team for the Brewers. I'm doing really well. I pitch really well. I'm finished the sixth inning. I go into the dugout. I go to get a cup of water. All right. So I pick up a cup to go fill it up at the Gatorade cooler.
Mm-hmm.
Little did I know it was an old cup and there's already water in there.
Mm-hmm.
My index finger goes into the cup, into the water. That little bit of moisture caused a blister the next inning.
Wow.
Like just that little bit. Yeah. That little bit of moisture. And in the Florida State League, it's humid, it's hot.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. I'm going along. I'm feeling fine. And I remember I let a pitch go to, I think Matt Gamble, and I could feel that blister pop on the ball.
Aye.
And then I had thought like, no big deal. Like I'll heal this up in no time. Yeah. I couldn't even throw.
Wow.
Like, I had to go on the disabled list for, I think in the minor leagues, you know, it's only a week, but I went out the next day. I told the manager, I'm like, oh, it's going to be fine. And then like you get the ball right off of that blister because it's right where you throw. It's like kind of like getting stuck with a hot poker, you know, and then you're doing things differently and it's trouble. Cause, and then you got to, you know, it's one thing for muscles and stuff to heal, but now you're talking getting skin and everything to heal. And those things take time.
I want to ask you, you talked about getting traded to the Marlins and how great it was for your career, but it, you know, was one of the most consequential trades that we've seen, I don't know, in a generation. Miggy Cabrera, of course, you know, changing teams, and you changing teams. I mean, that was an impact deal. But, yeah, Andrew Miller ended up being in that, Dontrelle Willis, some really good players in that trade. What's that like the first time that you get traded? I mean, as you mentioned, it did work out for your career, but you know, the Tigers had invested in you. You're in their system for 2.5 seasons, and then it's, oh, I guess I'm going somewhere else. Maybe they didn't want me. You know, how does that feel for a young guy just trying to make the beginning of his career and try to get going? And it's, no, okay, I'm going somewhere else now.
Yeah, I mean, it happened really quick for me. And like you said, like, I mean, what a big trade. I mean, and it happened a long time ago as well. I think for the Tigers' perspective, like, geez, like, you'd probably trade a whole A-ball team to get Miguel Cabrera if you knew what you knew now. You know, like, you'd be like, no problem. I think at the time, you know, the Angels were in on him and they were floating the Howie Kendricks and Irving Santanas in their system and everything. But for me, like I was, like I said, just such a late bloomer. You know, I went to short season. I went to a full season of A-ball. I did very well. But then like the next year, I was in the Florida State League for the majority of the year as a 24-year-old doing well. But like, again, not striking the world out, getting lots of ground balls. I got bumped to Double A the middle of August. I pitched in 4 starts in the middle of August, 2 of them being complete games, and get bumped to the fall league from there, and then pitch pretty well in the fall league as well. You know, kind of against more of your peers and more of the top prospects. So I went from kind of old guy in the Florida State League worrying about getting blisters and, you know, already filled up Gatorade cups to a month later, I'm in, you know, the prospect late in Arizona Fall League. And 2 weeks after the Fall League, I get traded to the Marlins. And so it happened really fast for me. Obviously, I felt no ill will to the Tigers at the time. I mean, so they had the Justin Verlanders, the Joel Zumayas, you know, they were kind of in win now mode. And then I, at the time, was still behind the Jair Jurgens, there are a couple other minor league guys, you know, the Andrew Millers and stuff like that. So to get to the big leagues and stick and stay with the Tigers probably wasn't going to be the easiest thing. So to get traded to the Marlins was huge for me. And it seems like forever ago that I was a Tigers minor leaguer, but you know, it went from, you know, not being close to the big leagues to I made one double A start the next year on opening day. And then I was in the big leagues. So it happened really fast for me.
All right. So you mentioned 2015 as your final season in the big leagues, and you don't, it's hard to know, you know, if you're Henry Aaron, you're like, I'm going to announce my retirement. I have done everything I need to do in the game. And now it is time for me to step aside in a grand ceremony. When you are a good relief pitcher who's pitched for 8 years and whose services have been in demand, and then you go into the offseason and you don't know, I assume it's not quite that cut and dried. So as you're going along after 15, and I assume you're thinking you're going to keep pitching, when you're not necessarily getting approached in the same way, what's your thought at that point? You know, you had a young family at that point. I think you just had your first kid or were about to, and baseball has been your life. And now it's, oh, okay, I might not be pitching anymore. What goes through your mind? Do you think, okay, it's time for me to be an orthodontist? Do you want to stay in baseball? Obviously you ended up in baseball, but what's the thought process there for somebody who's been, you know, just doing one thing for a long, long time and made a good living for 8 years and now has to pivot?
Yeah, I mean, it might sound kind of odd, but like I kind of almost consider myself kind of like an accidental major leaguer. You know, like my goal when I got drafted was to progress. Okay, as long as I was, because I had my degree, I actually had a job out of school that I ended up, you know, calling them and being like, not going to be able to come in for work. You know, I got drafted to play baseball. That's a whole nother story. But so, I mean, I had other, you know, a decent fallback option. As long as I was progressing to the big leagues, I was going to be fine with that. And like I said, you keep getting enough people out and you progress to the big leagues and you progress through arbitration and then you progress to free agency and stuff. So I'd always known, you knew it's going to end and everything. It's just a matter of what's the deal. And I think it was a pretty good barometer. I had a really good season with the Boston Red Sox in 2014. I mean, I pitched in 70 games with, you know, a low 2 ERA in the AL East. And it wasn't like teams were just throwing multi-year deals, you know, at me that off season. And so from my perspective, I was like, that's fine. This is as good as I could have pitched. And if the industry, as an economics major, if the supply of Burke Badenhop and the demand of these major league teams doesn't quite equal up, it's got to say something. You know what I mean? And like, by no means was I just going to be like, yeah, I'll just take a minor league deal. I probably would have rather not played, you know, coming off that season than gotten a major league deal. But the interest wasn't quite as robust, I guess. Like, there was a lot of interest, but everybody wanted to kind of get me for cheap.
Right.
You know, there's like, this would be a great guy to have for the value.
But right.
Like, we don't want to pay kind of what we think he's, you know, what he probably could be worth, which stinks. But at the same point, you know, as a realist, like, I kind of realized that. So then coming off a mediocre season in Cincinnati, I had a brutal first month. We didn't play very well. We were out of it pretty early. I had to face a lot of left-handers, which isn't really my forte necessarily.
Did serviceable,
you know, had a workman's type effort, but just knew I wasn't lighting the world on fire. And then there just wasn't a ton of interest that off season at, now it would have been like 33. So we had one kid at the time. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, I guess that is what it is. And from that standpoint, you know, from me, it's like, you kind of wonder when the end's going to be, sort of thing, and you want to play for as long as you can. But I wasn't the type of player that I really wanted to be a 4A player for the next 2 to 3 years, you know.
Yeah.
If I was going to be in the big leagues again, that's fine. If I had to take a step back to AAA to get back to the big leagues again, that's fine. And I just kind of fell on my face. I went to camp with the Nats and stunk. Went to AAA with the Rangers and stunk. And then that was kind of it. And then teams just kind of stopped calling. Again, like you said, it's kind of weird to go from a pretty good major leaguer to not want anymore. And I think the average fan kind of doesn't realize that. A lot of my buddies are kind of getting out of baseball into other things, and it's not a steady decline. It's a straight fall off a cliff.
Huh.
It's really a different feeling, and it's one that I can understand is not easy either.
So how did it come to be that you ended up with the Diamondbacks? It seems like this is a good fit. Dan Herron is a former guest on the podcast too. He also works for the Diamondbacks. And I was just, you know, when those hires were announced, I'm like, oh, I could sort of see what the Diamondbacks are trying to do here. They're trying to bring in, you know, guys with recent major league experience, good pitchers, but also guys who, you know, are thinkers and might go in a little bit of a different direction, whether it's dipping into analytics or whether it's, you know, providing a little bit of a different perspective, not necessarily the traditional. So how did that come to be, and how have you sort of fit into the system, which seems like a really interesting one, given how much the Diamondbacks pitching has improved, particularly last year, but how much the Diamondbacks pitching has improved in the recent past?
I'll start off that answer by prefacing that, like, I was a decent enough major league pitcher. Dan Herron was a very good.
He was very good. That's true. Okay. That's true. He won 150 games. Yeah. He was excellent. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, he was a big time starting pitcher. And like, you know, so he is like, if I'm ever the pessimist, he is the ultimate pessimist, you know? So it's nice that we can have the same types of conversations where I'm like, dude, you're an all-star. And I was more of a suspect than a prospect, but regardless.
Yes.
So the current regime for the D-backs were assistant GMs and, you know, heads of pro scouting and stuff when I was in Boston. So they had kind of seen that I used some of like the pitch data stuff and was pretty critically minded and analytically and kind of how I operated and stuff like that. So that when I fell on my face playing, Jared Porter, who is one of our assistant GMs,
yep,
had kind of reached out to me back when he was with the Cubs and was like, hey, you know, not sure if you're done playing, even though you probably are, but like just wondering, you know, what you're up to, if, you know, there's a blah, blah, you know, role you'd like to take. And so that was when he was with the Cubs. Things didn't kind of work out there. They were busy, you know, getting ready to win the World Series and probably not worried about hiring washed up former middle relievers, you know, which I understood. So then Mike Hazen takes the job from Boston to Arizona. Jared, you know, goes from Chicago to Arizona as well. And I kind of reached back out to them, you know, seeing if they'd still be interested in kind of, you know, a similar type of position. It was one that basically they'd have to make, you know,
yep,
similar to what Herron's position was. And they said, yeah, basically it was kind of like, let's try it on and figure something out. And my first season I was loosely based as like an analyst in baseball ops. So it was just too good of an opportunity to pass up. I mean, it's tough to get into the front office side of baseball, let alone like they're going to, hey, we're going to make you a position.
Yeah.
And I think it's worked out relatively well. Were they like me? I like working with them, and you know, we're continuing to moving on. And yeah, it's fun to be able to, we've got a great group and it's fun to be able to talk. I don't talk to Herron as much. I see him more in spring training and things like that, but I work more on like the baseball ops side. He's a little bit more on like kind of like the big league day-to-day type stuff. But yeah, it's a great group to work with, and I'm very fortunate. And you know, it's also awesome that, you know, we've got really good players that have been able to execute and play and have been fun to watch for the last, you know, going on a year and a half now.
I don't want to give away any secret sauce, and I don't want to put you on the spot or anything like that. So I'll try to ask this in a sort of roundabout way. So yeah, I mentioned Herron. He's working as kind of more of a strategist, more a little bit closer to the field. But, you know, despite the fact that you're more in a front office role, you want to convey your message to the field too. You'd like people to execute on the things that you talk about as well. And you have somebody like Mike Butcher, who has a ton of experience in baseball as a pitcher, as a pitching coach, and you know, has a great body of knowledge again, without getting into, okay, well, we obviously try to do this strategically, but how does that work? How does the message go from you to Butch and potentially get implemented in a Zach Greinke fastball or this situation or that situation? How do you go about that? Because that seems like one of the challenges of front offices in general. It's, I have a good idea. Right. I work in an office. Okay, the Diamondbacks don't play in an office. How does this come to fruition?
Yeah, I think it's and yeah, like being that conduit is pretty important, because you know the front office guys are, they're involved in everything, but they're also involved in numbers and salaries and you know budgets and things like that. So like when they think like, hey, you know, this kind of looks off, I think it's kind of off, or you know, maybe it's not my place to ask or whatever. I kind of can fill some of that role sort of, because I'm not good enough to be a big league pitching coach. I'm definitely not good enough to be a GM. So, you know, it's just kind of more stabs at it sort of, you know, like, cause sometimes like they see things that I can't, and sometimes that I might see things that they can't type of thing. And you just kind of take a collective effort at things, and working with Butch and working with Mike Fetters has been awesome. Working with our minor league pitching coaches, working with our scouts.
Yeah.
So I, you know, amateur and professional, because I probably do probably more of that type of, you know, like I think the initial when I got hired was, you know, pitching based acquisitions and things like that.
Yeah.
So working with our scouts and, you know, hey, I'm seeing this. Is that what, you know, some of the analytics stuff sees, or, you know, it's a two-way street or the other way, you know? So there's a lot of things I think that we've, you know, implemented, but a lot of things we're still, you know, still learning and stuff like that. And Butch has been awesome to work with. I mean, we've got really good pitchers on our major league staff well. So he's got a ton of things to worry about, and he can't always worry about, you know, some of the smaller minutia or whatever. And so hopefully I can fill some of those gaps essentially.
I want to ask you also about the evolution of today's game. We talked about the balls being juiced and all that stuff, but we're also just in such a lot. Well, I mean, I think it's a given at this point, but the velocity thing is so interesting, and you alluded to it earlier that, you know, throwing 90 was one thing in 1970 or even 2007, but doing so now, especially as a right-hander, you're an alien if you throw 90 and you're a right-hander. If you're a right-handed reliever, is there a guy who throws 90 as a right-handed reliever in baseball? I'm not sure. And you know, it's such an interesting thing. Are we just to the point now where you're obligated to be able to throw 97 out of the pen? Like, how have we gotten into too much homogeneity in baseball where it's just everybody's kind of the same, and yeah, you have to throw upper 90s with a hammer, otherwise you have no chance? Or is there room for guys who do things a different way? I guess Pat Neshek is sort of like, you know, if the Burke Bednop mold, and he's surviving, although his strikeout rate has pumped up a lot compared to earlier in his career. But it feels like more and more we're just going to one kind of guy, that everybody looks like the Yankees bullpen. They're all 6'8". They all breathe fire, and that's the end of that.
Yeah. I think it's just such an ebb and a flow. I also think the average fan probably doesn't realize how different things are pitcher to hitter.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like oil and water. I mean, in terms of like, it might as well be offense and defense and football, you know? Mm. And so even though you're on the same team, like there's such it's offense and defense, you know? And so while pitching has kind of evolved into, you know, this hitting's, I'm going to eventually start catching up. And I think then you're going to start seeing things go kind of the other way. Like, you know, one of our starters that's been very well documented, like Patrick Corbin, like, you know, manipulating the shape of his slider. He's throwing like slower slider type curveballs, you know, like Robbie Ray also, you know, throws really, really hard, but he's kind of got a softer curveball he mixes in as well. And things like that. And I think things will start to shift, you know, one way or the other. I think one thing that's kind of missed in this whole, like, oh, we've got to throw harder thing, and I alluded to, like, you know, the mid-90s Braves that I so loved. If you pull up some YouTube clips of Maddux and Smoltz and Pedro Martinez and all these guys, they're getting balls 3-4 inches off the plate called for strikes. So now we have to throw the ball over the plate, and rightly so. You know, like I think throwing all the ball over the plate for the strike zone makes sense. But now we zero it in, so it only makes sense that, like, hey, the harder you throw, the better chance we're going to get the ball by guys when we have to live over the plate a little bit more. I think, you know, pitchers will probably start to adapt just as hitters will. Cause I mean, I don't know if you saw, what was it? There's a big snuff made out of, you know, the Cardinals kid throwing 105.
Yeah. Jordan Hicks.
The thing that was the most impressive to me, Adubal Herrera fouled it off.
Yes.
Like, you know, I was like, yeah, this, you know, I knew this kid threw really hard. Like, I mean, is 105 that much different than, you know, I've seen him throw 103. But I was like, how did Adubal Herrera even see the pitch, you know, let alone, like, almost put it in play? And I think that bodes to the fact that being a major league hitter, man, is something else. And to have the hand-eye coordination, and they'll be able to time a bullet. So there's going to be a point, you know, where velocity isn't going to be the biggest thing, because it'll become more of the average, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, still the guys that are throwing, the guys that are, you know, the sitting 96, 7, 8 for a game of the center guards, those guys are going to be the guys that still throw hard. But the guys that sit 2, 3, 4, you know, that's kind of the average. And as guys get used to seeing the average, that's going to be where their average swing is, I think. So it'll be an ebb and a flow. Who knows? Watch. 10 years, we'll just have a slew of knuckleballers.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes. Stephen Wright, clone that guy. I love that stuff. Okay, so yeah, baseball, that's all lovely, but we gotta talk about Game of Thrones. We gotta do this. Listen, it's we're in Game of Thrones off season. Piper, it's okay. We gotta talk about Game of Thrones. I know you're a huge fan. Season 7 was insane. Lots of stuff went down. I don't care. We're doing a spoiler alert or whatever, but if you're not caught up, you're not caught up. If you haven't watched Game of Thrones yet, spoiler, whatever, we're talking about stuff that's happened already. How do we feel about, I think we have to start with John and Danny. How do we feel about John and Danny, this union, the fact that one of them is probably the chosen one, the fact that John bends the knee? Is this, did the show telegraph it too much? Because if you're like a hardcore fan, people knew that it was coming, other people did not. Does this jive with you the way that they came together? Or are you like, I don't know about these storylines?
No, I'm fine with it. So like, I do And one of the great parts of the show is delving into all the extra media, all the blogs, all the podcasts, all the, you know, everything. I, you know, keep very close tabs on, you know, what Mallory Rubin is doing, you know, and she seems to be the fount of knowledge in terms of, you know, Game of Thrones stuff and everything. So I, you know, John's parentage and the Danny and all that stuff, you know, I saw it coming, obviously. So I'm cool with it. I don't know. I'm a big White Walkers fan, man. That I want to like burn it down and everything, but like, I'm pumped whenever those guys are on,
they have a dragon
on the screen, and yeah, that's pretty
insane.
Cool. I mean, yeah, for sure. I forget who I was talking to, but my favorite moment in the whole series is when, you know, the Night King raises everybody back from the dead in that one scene. Like, that's it for me. Like, that's as cool as things can get, you know. Like, that was great storytelling, it was great cinematography and everything. So not that I'm rooting for the White Walkers, but I don't know, it's just getting really interesting.
I think it's okay to root for the White Walkers. There's a certain, you know, some of the main characters are just like, I don't know, so-and-so's a little bit of a prima donna, and so-and-so's a little this way and that way, and like, yeah, John is noble, but you know, that act has been played out for a while. There's something to be said for the anarchy part of it. And honestly, when the show is at its best, the Red Wedding was anarchy, and when the White Walkers attacked the Wall, and all this stuff, like, that's the good stuff when things go crazy, and there are some rational actors among the protagonists. I guess Cersei might be the closest to being a White Walker, because she's just like, yeah, I want to burn it all down. That's it. So I appreciate her game. Yeah. She's got hustle too. She's just like, yeah, I don't care. Does it benefit me? No. Okay, cool. Kill it. That's fine with me.
Yeah. Now, had you seen all this coming? Did you know of everything that was you know, down the pike with John and Danny and all that stuff?
So
did you play it spoiler free?
No, I ended up reading Mallory Rubin and Network too. I mean, I used to work with these people, right? Mal used to edit all my baseball.
Yeah,
she's fantastic. You can't. It's tough because you don't want it to be ruined, but at the same time, you're just like, it's so tempting to get into it. So, and it's the only show I think that I've done that with. Like, I haven't watched the most recent season, but I'm super into The Americans, and I tried not to spoil that. Although I guess it's different because you know, now I take back what I said, because with Game of Thrones, there's books, and obviously with the Americans, there isn't books.
Right.
But like, if I'm watching delayed episodes, I try not to read the recap until I've watched it or whatever. So I don't know. Like, have you read the books?
No, I tried to kind of like start, and I was just like, eh,
it's long.
I don't know. This is gonna, you know, because there's so much, extra stuff and everything. And
yeah.
So while I have also a fan of the Americans, finished, but at the same point, the Cold War happened.
Yes,
we know what
that's
happened.
True. So,
like, you know, like if all of a sudden nuclear bombs go off, that would be, you know, kind of not
off
on
brand.
Script, I
yes.
guess, per se. Yeah. So kind of like, wait, what's going on here? But, yeah, I kind of enjoy knowing the dots and then seeing how they connect the dots.
Yeah.
Or if there's any other dots they kind of, you know, add in there, you know, in the middle. It's also nice knowing, plenty of my friends are fans, knowing more than they do. You know, like, that's never not a fun thing. You
yes.
know, so when
yes.
they're kind of questioning, like, wait, what did I just see, or what's going on? You know, there's plenty of people that didn't quite even catch the, you know, John was the baby at the Tower of Joy
yes,
thing, because
yes.
I knew what was happening, but kind of just all they did was, you know, a face over from a baby to John. Some people kind of miss that.
Hmm.
There's nothing better than being like, how did you miss that? The whole thing is about that. How did you, you know, and knowing more than someone.
Did you?
Yeah, every day I think I'm like, it's one day closer to the next season of Game of Thrones. So.
Yes. Did you perceive a palpable difference? Like, people talk about, I think it was only the most recent season, if I'm not mistaken, where that was when there was no more source material, that you'd reached the end of the R.R. Martin oeuvre, and then you had to move on to just what the showrunners were doing. Obviously, you haven't read the books, but did you perceive,
right.
oh, they're taking more chances, or they're doing weirder things now than they did in the past? Or were you like, no, this is cool stuff, and that was cool stuff too, and I'm okay with all of it?
Yeah, I mean, like, the pace obviously sped up from,
yes,
you know,
big time.
35 to 100, which I wasn't a huge fan of. Like, kind of the slow crawl and the journey is kind of, I think, what the whole thing is about, sort of. You know, once you get there, it is what it is. There, obviously, once they got rid of past the source material, there was a lot less Theon, which I was fine with.
Yes, not know, the like, biggest Theon fan. You've been flayed and castrated. We know. We get it. It's fine.
Yeah, we get it. Like, I'm more interested in, you know, Alfie Allen, the actor, and being Lily Allen's brother. I'm like, get off the screen, man. I'm good with 20 minutes of you this week. But regardless, yeah, I mean, you could see the thing switch, and it's like, you know, how do we get from Dorne to, you know, Highgarden in no time type of thing?
Yes.
Which, I don't know, and the whole, you know, Gendry being the fastest runner on the face of the planet, that would have taken half of a season in the other time, and I understand those things, but you can't be too I guess I just wonder, like, was someone just kind of like, we got to speed this up, or like, why wouldn't, you know, HBO want to string it out for as long as they can? That's what's more curious to me.
Well, I guess they had a contract and they wanted to fulfill it and get done with it, so that was probably about it.
Yeah, something.
Hopperman, it was great to chat with you and great to catch up. I am very happy that you're enjoying life working for the Diamondbacks, and you're one of the smartest people I've met around the game, so it's cool that you're able to contribute. You and Heron both contributing in that way, with a staff that includes Greinke, who's like the most interesting human of all time. So that's always a lot of fun. So thank you for this, and I wish you all the best.
Oh, thank you so much.